headlines. People in the Yemeni capital Sana'a and other cities staged massive rallies to condemn the U.S. move to blacklist the Ansarullah movement. Russia issues a protest to the U.S. embassy over Washington's support for the rallies held by supporters of opposition figure Alexei Navalny. The former British premier warns that the U.K. could become a failed state as it grapples with the coronavirus pandemic, nationalism, and post-Brexit uncertainty. Hello, welcome. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Yemenis hold mass protests in the capital Sana'a to denounce the U.S. decision to blacklist the country's Ansarullah movement. The demonstrators called on the U.S. government to reverse the decision. Similar rallies were also held in the southern port city of Hodeidah and the city of Sana'a in the north. 170 Yemeni NGOs have also condemned the U.S. decision. Former U.S. President Donald Trump designated Ansarullah as a foreign terrorist organization in the final days of his administration. The designation triggered protests from the United Nations and international aid groups. UN officials say that the move will further complicate efforts to combat the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Ansarullah has been leading Yemen's fight against Saudi-led invaders over the past 5 years. Political commentator Hossein Abulkheiti says the U.S. blacklisting of the Ansarullah movement will add to the suffering of the Yemeni nation caught in the years-long war.
Of course, this latest designation actually will affect many United Nations and other NGOs who are working on Yemen because we have this blockade in Yemen, the closure of the airport, and only like every 2 or 3 months, few flights come to Sana'a with the food and medicine, and as well Saudi Arabia after 3 or 5 to 6 months of blocking ships to go into Yemen. Sometimes they let some ships every now and then, but this latest designation actually will affect those international NGOs in Yemen work. It will affect the money transferred from outside to those NGOs in Sana'a or in other city. And I believe this was the main goal from this latest designation. Saudi Arabia, after they couldn't break the Yemeni people, they destroyed all port and airport. They want to make Yemeni suffer. They think that Yemenis are stupid, that we're going to blame, and me as Yemeni, we're going to blame the Houthi for this, for what's happening in Yemen. That's why this latest designation, it wants to stop the pressure and the suffering of Yemeni people. But this latest protest, it shows that despite the fact Yemen is under blockade, as under constant attack for the last 6 war, Yemeni are actually going to be united and they will fight back.
Leading human rights organization Amnesty International has published a report decrying the inhumane conditions in Egyptian prisons. Amnesty says inadequate health care has made prisoners suffer unnecessarily and in some cases may have resulted in death. The report also noted that preventative hygienic measures are impossible to implement in the face of COVID-19 and that treatments are non-existent in case of infection. Amnesty International says it has investigated 12 deaths in custody or shortly after release and is aware of 37 other cases. The report focuses on the situation in 16 prisons between February and November 2020. The Egyptian government, however, has rejected reports of bad prison conditions and accusations of torture in jail. Russia has issued a strong protest to the U.S. for supporting illegal rallies against the detention of opposition figure Alexei Navalny. The Russian Foreign Ministry said that Moscow has complained to the U.S. Embassy about the issue. Moscow says American social media posts have been promoting anti-Kremlin demonstrations. Moscow says it will probe American IT companies for interference in Russia's internal affairs. Rallies have been held in several Russian cities, with protesters calling for the release of Navalny. Opposition figure was arrested last week after returning from Germany, where he had been receiving treatment for alleged poisoning in Russia. Our correspondent Marina Kortanova joins us from Moscow. Marina, so tell us how the U.S. has been supporting the illegal rallies, as we have just reported in our news.
As you know, thousands in major cities of Russia on Saturday joined protest in support not only of jailed opposition figure Alexei Navalny, who leads anti-corruption investigations, as well as against bad results of the socio-economic policy of the authorities. Earlier, Moscow voiced its concerns over the fact that the U.S. embassy had published information about where unauthorized rallies were taking place across Russia. Russian Foreign Ministry says that the U.S. support for rallies in Russia is direct meddling. So the country's deputy foreign minister has expressed displeasure to the U.S. ambassador over the embassy's support of protest rallies across the country. And today it became known that Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Rybkov held a conversation with U.S. Ambassador John Sullivan and expressed his strong objection to posts by the U.S. Embassy in Russia supporting rallies in some Russian cities, which it spread online. It was explained to the U.S. ambassador that the Russian side considers this material and the statement by the U.S. Department of State as direct interference in the domestic affairs of Russia. Moscow has called on the U.S. embassy to respect Russian laws and universal diplomatic regulations. So the ministry also said that Moscow will research what role Facebook and other U.S. online giants play in protests across Russia. Experts say that school children were brought to the protest by Chinese social net TikTok. They attributed this to the fact that social networks, namely TikTok, played an important role in the campaign. It is known that the main audience of this site is mainly teenagers from 14 to 17 years old. For them, this online campaign seems fashionable and cult. And the League of Safe Internet found over 100,000 campaign videos in various social networks, primarily TikTok, where children were invited to walk action. Now, Roskomnadzor, it is a Russian federal service for supervision of communications, has already blocked a number of such messages on internet platforms and promised to hold the authors accountable for agitating teenagers to participate in protests. So now all federal media are broadcasting about this here in Russia. However, for my part, I can add that the main category of citizens who went out to the streets of Russian cities last Saturday was 29 old and above. So here the authorities stubbornly forgetting to indicate the main reason for the protests in the country: the impoverishment of the population, unemployment, and corruption at all levels.
Thank you for that. We appreciate it. Marina Kortanova there from Moscow. Many thanks. Moving on with the news, former British Prime Minister Gordon Brown warns that the UK must reform how it is governed or it risks becoming, quote, a failed state. Brown says that the COVID-19 crisis, as well as nationalism and uncertainty about the post-Brexit Britain, threatens the unity of the kingdom. He said unity depends on a fair and workable delineation of powers after Brexit. Brown's warning comes as the Brexit and the COVID-19 crises have weakened the bonds between England, Wales, Scotland, and Northern Ireland. The UK has faced many political hurdles and experienced an economic downturn since the start of the pandemic and its separation from the EU single market. Rob Carter says that people across Britain have lost trust in their leaders because of political inequalities and their handling of the coronavirus pandemic.
I think that distrust in Westminster is at an all-time high, even people within England itself. And you have to remember that the UK is a very English-centric country. Scotland, Wales, and the north of Ireland feel very left out in terms of investment, in terms of political say, and so ultimately those countries within the UK are starting to realize now that, do you know what, we're probably going to be better off alone. They don't trust leaders like Boris Johnson. They didn't vote for Brexit. They don't believe that Westminster has handled the COVID crisis acceptably at all. And in fact, if comparisons are made between Scotland's regional governments and Westminster itself, Scotland tends to act a lot quicker, and so does Wales, for example, in initiating lockdowns, in stopping people going back to school or going back to work, than Westminster has. So ultimately, people across the country are just deeply dissatisfied with Westminster. They don't particularly identify as being British anymore. They're starting to identify as Scottish, Welsh, or their local native denomination, and that is a reality that Westminster just doesn't seem to have to understand. They think that by ignoring the Scottish independence movement or by, you know, issuing threats or refusing to give them a referendum until 2050, as Boris Johnson has put it, that it will just go away. But the problem is boiling under the surface, and it's only a matter of time before it spills over.
The British Prime Minister says that his government is weighing up tougher border control due to what he called the risk of vaccine-busting new COVID-19 variants. Boris Johnson said that his government wants to make sure that it protects the country and the population against reinfection from abroad. The UK has tightened coronavirus restrictions in recent weeks as it is battling with a new highly transmissible strain of COVID-19. Britain's current lockdown bans most international travel, requires a negative test for travelers, and a period of quarantine upon arrival. The country is one of the worst affected nations by the pandemic in Europe. So far, it has recorded more than 3.6 million infections, with over 98,000 deaths. The Netherlands police arrest about 250 people amid violent nationwide protest against a curfew to curb the spread of COVID-19. Police used dogs and water cannon to disperse the protesters in Amsterdam. In the southern city of Eindhoven, police fired tear gas to disperse a crowd of several hundred. Similar incidents were reported in other cities, including The Hague, Breda, and Arnhem. Curfew, which is the country's first since World War II, is set to last until February 10. The Netherlands was already under its toughest measures since the start of the pandemic. New variants of the virus, particularly a more infectious strain that first emerged in Britain, have led to deep concerns in Europe. Turkey and Greece have launched the first round of direct talks in nearly 5 years in a bid to de-escalate tensions over maritime disputes in the eastern Mediterranean Sea. The so-called exploratory talks are held in the Turkish city of Istanbul. Two sides were still trading barbs in the days leading up to the meetings. Last week, the Greek prime minister said that Athens would approach the talks with optimism, but zero naivety. The Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, has expressed hope that the resumption of negotiations would mark the start of a new era in bilateral ties. Turkey has been at loggerheads with Greece and Cyprus over an energy-rich area in the Mediterranean Sea. Tensions flared up last year after Ankara deployed an exploration vessel to the contested waters. The move floundered plans for the resumption of Athens-Ankara negotiations that have been stalled since the year 2016. Russian Sagalam is our correspondent joining us from Istanbul. So we're looking at these talks. There should be some optimism in it. Is there?
Well, actually, if we look at the talks from outside the building where it is taking place, which is 5 minutes away from where I am right now, we should expect some positive ambience or atmosphere. As per all the politicians who attended, or as per the two sides, the Turkish side and the Greek side, as we heard and as you mentioned, that the Greek Prime Minister said that they are optimistic. Also, on the Turkish side, we heard Hulusi Akar, the Turkish Defense Minister, as well as Foreign Minister, saying that they are optimistic about these talks. However, if we want to take a historic shift to 2002, when those talks started between the two neighboring countries, this is actually the 61st negotiation between the two countries to solve bilateral ties, or bilateral disputes, to solve maritime boundaries, to solve all the disputes that they have between each other. However, nothing is solved yet. So if we want to look deeply and closely, we don't expect that today we are going to find a solution to all the problems that those two neighboring countries have. The issue is not about only the East Mediterranean. It is a historic issue. It is due to after the war. It is a problem that has to do with the Greek-Turkish borders not being defined as both countries want. Each country, of course, wants a bigger piece of the cake. Also, the biggest cake is going to be in the East Mediterranean, and each country has his own map and his own borders that they drew themselves for East Mediterranean. Also, we have the disputes about the refugees and refugee deal that was made between Turkey and EU, which Greece also do not agree upon, also opening the borders from the Turkish side whenever something happens. So I think they have a lot to discuss, and those things will not be resolved in one-day meetings. And of course, if we want to look at who is actually in the meeting is led by, from the Turkish side, Deputy Foreign Minister, and from the Greek side, it is a retired diplomat. So I think that this is the beginning of negotiations, beginning of talks, but if we want to reach a solution, I think that it is going to be a higher rank of diplomats meeting on the negotiation table. I think that this meeting is just to pave the way for other talks to follow and to see what every country has, or the calls or needs for each and every country. Now, they're putting on the table what they want from each other, and of course those delegations will go to their superiors and discussions will take place. Of course, And we will see what will happen next. We either going to witness another round of war and of course speeches and of course disputes, or we are going to witness another round of negotiations and talks. This depends on what's going to happen in this meeting and whether this meeting is going to get out, the diplomats in this meeting are going to get out with good results, with things on the agenda to be discussed, actually. We all know that for Turkey and for Greece, they both set limits. So there is limits to what they are ready to offer. I think that the dispute between the two countries are very deep and they need more than one day negotiations. And of course, we spoke to some analysts here in Istanbul who said that they don't expect anything from this meeting, and this is why the meeting was not open to the press. It's a closed meeting because it is not the final one. It is just to put things clear and to just show a gesture of goodwill and optimism. And of course, this meeting was welcomed by EU members, was welcomed by the NATO. So I think that it is a goodwill from both sides. We've seen Turkey willing to sit on the negotiation table. However, Greece was not agreeing on that. And to reach this point, it is very important, actually.
Okay, thank you for that. Russia Sagalam, our correspondent there from Istanbul. Many thanks. Moving on with the news, a Russian pipeline or pipelaying ship involved with the Nord Stream 2 pipeline project has begun its work 1 week after sanctions threat by the previous U.S. administration. Now, that's according to the company that owns the ship. The company says the Fortuna is now engaged in building a corridor in the waters off Denmark ahead of resuming the Nord Stream construction. Several Russian support vessels are also said to be in the immediate vicinity. The 10 billion euro pipeline that will run beneath the Baltic Sea is to double Russian natural gas shipments to Germany. The pipeline, which is more than 90% complete, has long been a contentious issue for the U.S., especially under former President Donald Trump. Washington has imposed many rounds of sanctions on companies involved in the project, arguing that it would increase Europe's reliance on Russian energy. China has accused the U.S. of what it calls flexing its muscles by often sending warships and aircraft into the South China Sea. Foreign Ministry spokesman Zhao Lijian said the U.S. moves are not conducive to peace and stability. On Saturday, a U.S. carrier group led by USS Theodore Roosevelt entered the South China Sea. That after Taiwan claimed an incursion by Chinese warplanes into its air defense identification zone. The strategic waters, also claimed by several regional countries, have long been a focus of contention between Beijing and Washington. China is also critical of U.S. boosting ties with self-ruled Taiwan, which it views as part of its territory. Beijing has repeatedly urged Washington to abide by the One China policy and to stop interfering in its internal affairs. That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Closer, Iran.
Hello. I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. My country, Iran, is a vast land with four seasons. The four-season feature in Iran brings about the experience of winter tourism in one place and summer tourism in another at the same time. For example, rain, wavy seas, storm, beautiful rivers, desert. All and all are available in just one land. Today we are going to visit northwest of Iran to see one of the wonders of this region, the Takht-e-Suleyman Lake of Takab. Takht-e-Suleyman, meaning Throne of Solomon, is an archaeological site in West Azerbaijan province, which used to be known as Ganjak very long time ago. Today this region is called Takht-e-Suleyman. Takht-e-Suleyman site is 45 kilometers northeast of the city of Takab. The ancient area of Takht-e-Suleyman includes Sassanid and Ilkhanid gates, Azargoshasp fire temple, and Anahita temple. At the center of this archaeological site, there is a lake which is actually the beating heart of this historical complex. The Takht-e-Suleyman lake is a calcium-rich spring with thousands of years of age, which outflows water rigorously from the deep underground water. The water, which boils at a depth of more than 120 meters, is saturated with minerals so that it cannot be used for drinking or farming. I am now in the area of Takht-e-Suleyman. It's really cold in here. I'd better wear my gloves. There is snow everywhere, and the scenery is really fascinating. I have to walk further to reach the lake. Spectacular! The amount of minerals in the lake is so much, so it is not possible to dive or even see through the depth of the lake. That is why they say there is secrets about this lake. And there are also local legends. There is a story which says, one Solomon struck his stick to the ground, and a spring started flowing and created the lake which today is called Takht-e-Suleyman. And here there is a notice. Oh, well, wearing my glasses, so I have to get close to see what's written. It reads, no swimming. Of course, no one ever swims in such a freezing weather. Oh, well, what's this? Oh, God. It's a gravestone. This grave belongs to a person who has gone swimming in the lake and drowned. This season, which sunlight reflects off the snow, steam rise off the lake. It's a really mysterious and enchanting scenery. I can't take my eyes off of these beauties. I'd like to stand here forever and stare at this foggy lake. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the sermons and letters and sayings of Imam Ali alayhi salam. And we are presently discussing the 184th sermon of Nahjul Balagha, which is also known as the Sermon of the Pious People or the Khutbatul Muttaqeen in Arabic. And we have reached this phrase where Imam Ali alayhi salam speaks about contentment of the soul, contentment of the nafs, where he says that you will see that this person who is pious is qani'atan nafsuh, that his soul is in a state of contentment. His nafs, that means his heart also, I mean, nafs of course has different translations. You can say the heart, or you can say the soul, or the self is in a state of contentment. And in the previous session, we were trying to understand what contentment means exactly, especially since we have been encouraged in Islam to be a community that upgrades itself economically, politically, socially. At the same time, we are told to be content. So how do we understand that? And we gave a few of the ways to understand this conflict and kind of solve this conflict. And we gave a few points. One of the main points that we discussed about was the fact that Islam is actually a religion of peace. That means it tries to remove conflicts within the heart and outside in the society. As such, contentment should be in that direction. In fact, if not developing and progressing leads to a worse situation, then that is discouraged. This was one of the answers. Inshallah, we will discuss this today in greater depth.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, when it comes to the idea of contentment, when we say that a person is content, basically we mean that a person suffices to the needs that are there to, in the community or in himself. That means if something is able to suffice that need within him, that is enough. He should be content with that. There are various needs. One of the needs of men is also to have recreation. One of the needs, for example, is food, drink, and all of these things. These are all needs of men. And one of the needs also is to enjoy. Okay, and so that's why, for example, just not just drink, but have an enjoyment in that drinking, or for example, in eating, or in any other activities. So all these are needs that a man has. Beyond that need, like a person now has satisfied that need to enjoy, to, for example, have recreation, to eat, whatever. Now he's becoming greedy. He wants more. In such a situation, it leads to some level of conflict in the society and within him. Because when a person transgresses the requirement that he has in his existence, that means he's giving more attention to the material dimension, and therefore it directly comes in conflict with the spiritual dimension, and therefore you see there is a state of unhappiness, there is a state of lack of peace in the heart. And also it leads to external problems, like people fight with one another to have more of everything.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
So, when we speak about progress, we mean progress that is in line with the perfection of men. And sometimes that progress would mean that a person, becomes stronger economically, socially, and politically. That doesn't mean that a person in the name of progress starts to become greedy, that then he'll fall back into the same trap that he was trying to run away from. The reason why we want economic progress and political progress and social progress is that a human society, an Islamic and a Muslim society, become strong and the conflicts within and without are solved. Now, if a person during this progress starts to become greedy, again those conflicts will come back. You see? So, you are trying to run away from conflicts by creating progress, but then in your progress, you want to create more conflicts. So, at the end of the day, it becomes a vicious circle and a destructive circle at that. And that is why we say that it is important for a person and for people to keep in mind that the actual reason behind all of these addicts is that a human being reaches a state of equilibrium, a state of peace and lack of conflict from within. Once a person achieves this state of lack of conflict from within, that is that particular state of that is in line with the actual contentment. Therefore, we understand what we mean by progress together with contentment. Progress to avoid the state of conflict, progress to avoid poverty and lack of a clear understanding of the universe and ignorance, that is progress. But then that progress should be toned to the necessities. And that is the way we try to understand these narrations and what they are trying to tell us, inshallah. Let us pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that He gives us the opportunity to have the right form of progress and also to be able to be content with the needs, with what solves those needs inside our hearts. At the same time, don't fall into a state of laziness where we give the excuse of being content for not working hard towards economic, social, and intellectual progress of the societies. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
The Biden administration's first steps have already disappointed housing and racial justice activists who say bold action is urgently needed to keep people in their homes amid a deepening housing crisis, says Mike Ludwig, reporter, in an article published under the heading, Biden has extended eviction moratorium. Now it's time for more. Stay tuned for the details, please. The Biden administration's first steps have already disappointed housing and racial justice activists who say bold action is urgently needed to keep people in their homes amid a deepening housing crisis. Under Biden's direction, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, extended a moratorium on evictions through March 31st. The moratorium may prevent a mass eviction crisis in the infancy of Biden's presidency as Congress debates fair action. But the existing moratorium put in place by the Trump administration has failed to uniformly prevent landlords from pushing low-income families out of their homes during a deadly pandemic. In statements and interviews, tenant organizers and advocates for low-income renters said they are still fighting eviction processings in a number of states despite the CDC moratorium. Families are still being pushed into crowded shelters and onto the streets. Landlords in just five states filed for 4,901 evictions last week, according to Princeton University Eviction Lab, which has counted more than 220,000 evictions since the pandemic began, despite moratoriums enacted by cities and states. Extending the current CDC policy does not actually end evictions, particularly in states with weaker protections like Missouri and Kentucky, said Tara Ravenver, director of the Housing Guarantee Campaign at People's Action, in an email. Biden's decision means that courts around the U.S. will continue to hear evictions and force tenants to the streets while the pandemic rages on. Many Black, Latinx, and indigenous communities faced the housing crisis long before the pandemic began. Structural racism has generated stark racial inequalities in the housing system for centuries, and people of color are overrepresented among the estimated 14 million people who are currently behind on rent as unemployment remains rampant. Evictions and housing inequality are linked to increased spread of COVID-19 and higher rates of infection and health among Black, Latinx, and indigenous people, according to a study published in November. For weeks, housing and racial justice activists warned the incoming Biden administration that the CDC moratorium is broken, in part because it does not prevent landlords from filing for evictions in local courts. The Trump administration left the moratorium intentionally weak, with no real mechanisms for enforcement, allowing landlords to exploit loopholes and leaving millions of renters unprotected, according to the Right to the City Alliance. As Biden's transition team prepared for Inauguration Day, a coalition of groups released a letter with a list of specific fixes that would strengthen the moratorium, which currently places the burden on tenants to apply for protection under the moratorium in court. In many cases, families staring down a crisis do not know the moratorium exists. The coalition called on Biden to strengthen the moratorium by executive order. Yet the flurry of orders released by the White House since Biden took office does not include any specific on housing and evictions. It would have been easy to improve the failed Trump moratorium, and Biden should have done so. Ravenveer said, choosing not to welcome at the cost of human life. Biden does have some proposals for addressing racial housing disparities over the longer term, and his administration quickly extended the moratorium on evictions and foreclosures of rural homes enrolled in certain federal mortgage programs. The administration will also continue a pause on federal student loan collections, but many activists note the administration could have taken much stronger action toward actually canceling debt. Another executive order asks federal agencies to remove barriers to benefit, such as unemployment benefits and nutrition assistance, a policy no-brainer for Democrats replacing a Republican administration. Biden's first moves are all administrative actions the White House was able to take quickly. By extending the CDC eviction moratorium for only 2 months and without the stronger provisions, Biden signaled that he is leaving the job of protecting renters for the remainder of the pandemic up to Congress. Biden is asking Congress to pass $1.9 trillion rescue stimulus package that would extend the eviction and foreclosure moratorium through September. Along with new unemployment benefits, the package would provide $25 billion in emergency assistance for struggling renters on top of $25 billion Congress approved last month. With millions of people owing an estimated $70 billion in back rent as of last month, advocates for low-income renters say up to $100 billion is needed. While the proposal would funnel another $5 billion through assistance programs that help low-income households pay energy and water bills, it does not include a national moratorium on utility shutoffs, as some had hoped. Utilities make homes livable, but only 17 states currently require utility companies to continue providing service during the pandemic, regardless of a customer's ability to pay. Biden is also asking Congress to fund his administration's sweeping plans for speeding up the delivery of COVID vaccines and streamlining the government's pandemic response. The rescue package includes some long-time progressive priorities, such as raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour. However, raising the minimum wage will likely be opposed by conservative lawmakers and millions of people struggling to pay for basics such as food and rent will not magically see their debt to landlords and bill collectors disappear when the pandemic subsides. Housing justice activists have bigger ideas for addressing the housing crisis, which they see as crucial for protecting people from COVID and addressing rampant racial inequality, two of the Biden administration's stated goals. Backed by activist Representative Ilhan Omar has pushed the Rent and Mortgage Cancellation Act, which would cancel rent and mortgage payments for the duration of the pandemic and allow landlords to recoup their losses by applying with a federal relief fund. Some activists prefer rent cancellation to direct rent relief payments because undocumented renters and others may be unable to apply for relief from the government. Housing justice activists are also demanding non-congregate housing for everyone currently living in shelters, jails, prisons, group homes, and nursing homes where social distancing is difficult or impossible. They see emergency pandemic housing as a step towards a homes guarantee that would finally eradicate homelessness by providing public, eco-friendly housing. Caldwell and others who have faced eviction have embraced proposals to reinvest in existing public housing and build 12 million new homes to provide a social housing option below market rental rates. Public housing is not new, but activists say the existing system is plagued by austerity and the same systematic racism that causes widespread housing inequality to begin with. Meaningful federal investment in a homes guarantee with a spare construction of energy-efficient homes across the U.S., creating badly needed jobs in green construction, according to the Justice Collaborative. We need to transform housing from commodity to public good, Caldwell said. This is not a time for incrementalism. This is a time for systematic overhaul, he said.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 41 meters 7300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا ومولانا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين المعصومين السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته dear listeners welcome to another episode of Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio. It's a very beautiful tradition from Imam Ridha alayhi salam, the eighth holy Imam. But before we get into the tradition, we should understand that, you know, we live in a world today where it is seen or it is, you know, told to us that, you know, being lonely is a bad thing. You should not be lonely. However, by actually pondering upon this tradition, we come to understand that a human being can never be lonely. This is just one aspect of the tradition we can pull out, that we are never lonely. We always have a friend with us if we actually apply this tradition in its correct manner. So if the Imam alayhi salam, that is Imam Ridha alayhi salam, says that every man's friend is his intellect. And the enemy of every man is his foolishness. So here, for example, there is a contrast between two keywords that we know has been mentioned many times. One that is of the aql, and the conflicting term or the antonym of the aql is jahl. And in this book that we are using, it has been translated as foolishness, and the authors gave their reasons why. But it can also be said to be ignorance, or, you know, not being able to truly come to grips of what you are meant to do. You know, you're lackadaisical, a jahal. So here, for example, if we ponder upon the tradition, we see that the Imam alayhi salam comparing the intellect to a friend, and jahal or ignorance or foolishness to that of an enemy, we have to come a step back and say, okay, why is the Imam saying this? Let us look at the example of what is a purpose, or what is the purpose of a friend. A true friend is that individual who only has the best interests of his friend at heart. All he wants is the best for that person. He will not, you know, guide him towards something that is bad for him. For example, if he's going towards something bad, he will advise him, don't go there. If he's stopping from doing something good, he tells him, go and do it. On the opposite, an enemy is that person who does not wish any goodness for that person. An enemy will wish for the destruction of that person, be it physically, spiritually, mentally, whatever way you wish, you know, or whatever way you wish to see it. This is why the Imam alayhi salam is comparing it, you know, to a friend and to an enemy. That the intellect, if used properly, that intellect will guide you towards that which is good and keep you away from that which is bad, just like a friend will. And however, if you don't have a proper intellect, if that aql is not working properly, it is not to its capacity that you have been given, and it is you have jahal, then obviously it will not be able to stop you from that which is bad and guide towards that which is good. You might think you are going towards good, or you might think that you are not doing which is bad. Inshallah, until next time, my dear brothers and sisters. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your